Hey everyone, this is Connor. Before we get started, I just want to encourage you to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/podsidepicnic. If you become a patron, you'll get access to multiple exclusive episodes every month. And you can also join our patrons-only Discord chat, where Pete and I talk informally with the Podside Picnic community. So if you like the show, go ahead and check us out at patreon.com/podsidepicnic. Thanks.
Welcome back to Podside, everyone. This is Carlo reporting for duty, sir. Accompanied by Fall In, Chris.
Hey, I got this dynamite.
All right. you got to drop and give me 20 now. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, folks, we're going to be talking about Joe Dante's 1998. This is 98, right?
Yes,
Small
it is.
Soldiers. Mm-hmm. And as we're going back, we're gonna go revisit Dante's Inferno. I think Chris, you and I had sort of thought about talking about this rather recently, mm-hmm. and so this came out. What is it? Let's see here. It was released in July 10th, 1998. Actually did not too bad for a 98, like a 1998 movie, right?
Yep.
Budget was 40 and made back 70, almost 72.
Okay.
Directed by none other than, you know, Joe Dante, of course. Mm-hmm. So had you ever seen this one before? I had not.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I had absolutely. This was, I don't recall. Don't remember if I saw it in theaters. I definitely remember I had this on VHS in one of those old, like big plastic clamshell cases they used to have that like all the Disney movies came in.
Like the Disney movies. Yeah.
And in fact, I believe that this was actually, I'm sorry. This was DreamWorks. I'm thinking of something else. But yeah, so the big ones, that the Disney ones, this one came in that, and I definitely watched that a number of times. So
I would say that in the beginning, let's not forget, like DreamWorks was trying to really edge into some of Disney's market share.
So absolutely.
We could talk about it whenever we get around to the Shrek franchise or whatever. but like, you know, it's obvious that they were trying to be the sort of like, this is the Disney your parents don't really want you to watch.
That's right. Yeah.
I think that to a certain extent, this was as I was reading up on this a little bit, the tiniest bit. I think I saw that, you know, basically Dante had it in his head that this was going to be like essentially aged up initially. Mm-hmm. Or it's like a sort of like a movie for teenagers, and then it seems like there were a variety of different product tie-ins that then sort of
made
we can get into it because I do think that is the thing that probably just detracts completely from.
I know what you're trying to say, I get it. But that said, I think this is a great movie. I really enjoy this movie. Now I don't, you know, there's might be some, you know, nostalgia baked into that, but I do think it's very successful at what it does. And as I was, you know, saying to you last night as I was watching this, which I kind of use our DM as like my notes app, so I apologize about that, but
it makes sense. I think it makes sense anyway, but go ahead.
So like there is a whole glut of these kind of movies in the 90s that were aimed at this like preteen and possibly younger audience, aiming for like a Nickelodeon show type of tone that was employing like high concept you know, ideas, sometimes sci-fi, sometimes not. But then adding just a little bit more risque than it would be allowed on, you know, basic cable. Mm-hmm. And for my money, and I'm thinking of like, so when I say Nickelodeon tone, I'm talking like pre the Dan Schneider like sitcom machine. I'm talking mm-hmm. like Alex Mack. I'm talking like, you know, those kind of, that kind of show where it was like, you know, there's a sci-fi element, but then there's also kids dealing with something. Right. This movie, I think, and then the movies I'm talking about are like Heavyweights or Camp Nowhere or, you know, other things of along those lines. I think Small Soldiers is probably the apotheosis of those types mm-hmm. of movies. It is the, you know, the absolute peak, and all you need is just an absolute master of, you know, like a guy who was raised in the trenches of a B movie factory, coming in and like who's just like, you know, a little bit better than you know, your not a little bit, a lot better than your average director, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it really sings with like some really like, there's some good satire, there's some really good some like really funny character beats. Mm-hmm. Some good action, some good side special effects, and it's just a fun time.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I feel like it felt like I was being harsher than I really meant. I was very entertained. I think that there's lots to like in this movie. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I did get this feeling that it felt somewhat, some of the critiques in it felt a little defanged.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I totally get that. And it's true because it's, mm-hmm. you know, Joe Dante, like, you know, he, you know, Gremlins was like really pretty wild for what is essentially a PG movie. Right. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, I think Gremlins was part of, but not the exact impetus, but the part of the move towards a PG-13 rating. Which this movie does get that, which I believe pissed off Burger King because they were promoting like toys and stuff like that from it. Yep. So they were hoping for like a more family friendly rating.
It is funny because the it is Gremlins and Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom that convince the MPAA that there needed to be a PG-13 rating, which right. weirdly, Chris, maybe my logic's a little faulty, but I always thought that PG-13 was less than PG, but I guess it's more, right?
Oh, it is. Yeah. So it goes G, PG, PG-13. Don't you remember they used to have the like cartoon posters with like, there was like a rabbit and stuff like that who was like in a trench coat. Like it was, you almost look like a flasher, like at one point.
Great. Yeah. This is a great symbol for the MPAA.
But yeah, PG-13 was like, you know, meant to be like, you know, we suggest it should be kids over 13 or, yeah, yeah. you know, around that age.
Yeah.
I think the 90s in particular, like, you know, the 80s went pretty wild with kids movies. Like kids movies were pretty wild in the 80s. Mm. And in the 90s, they kind of pulled back on that.
Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, I do think that there is something to be said about this movie actually, you know, feeling much more of a kid's movie. I would, when you were going through the sort of like the descriptor that, like the Nickelodeon tone, the thing that immediately popped into my head was something, and this might not fit your exact description or whatever, but like something like Clarissa Explains It All, where it's really what it's demographic is like almost a middle grade, mm-hmm. but aspiring towards mm-hmm. like a young adult you know, type of thing. Right.
No, I think you're spot on there. And with the high concept there being like, she speaks directly to camera. She's like the, you know, the ultimate like trendy girl of that age, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and she's smart, and she knows what she's about, and stuff like that.
She also creates. This just popped in my head. She creates video games about whatever issue is like she's going through at that time, if I remember correctly.
I only caught like this or that episode, you know, like glancingly because I was just too old for it. It was just not.
Yeah, I think this is. Yeah, this is. You know, that part. I think this is the age gap between us a little bit coming to fruition.
Yeah, no, I mean, that makes sense, because like I was aware of it, I think, through my sisters and stuff like that. But it was something that you know how it is. If you've ever been like an older sibling, your younger siblings are watching something and you'll like watch it for a second just to sort of like categorize it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go, okay, this is that. Now that I know what this is, I know this is also not for me. I'm getting out of here.
Yeah.
Like if you want to be mean, you just sit around and you MST3K it, you know?
Right. Yes, exactly.
but in any case, I do think that this movie, to your point, does really capture that same feeling, right? Because, and we should probably, this is such a weird movie because it starts with the adults. Mm-hmm. Like it starts with, what is it, David Cross and Jay Mar?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
The missing Jay Mar. Whatever. Well, I possibly don't want to know because he probably turned into a child or something.
Yeah. I don't think he. Yeah. I don't know. But nothing. Nothing's really coming to mind. I think he has a podcast. Which everybody does. Hey, we're talking on one right now. So
what? Wait, we're not in person, Chris. I've been lied to. But yeah, like Jay Mar, who I remember being possibly one of the best impressions of Christopher Walken on the planet.
Yeah, Jay Mar. I think he was actually I like Jay Mar. He had a show on Fox in the like early 2000s called Action, I think it was, where he's like it was kind of like a proto Entourage, but with like a much sharper Hollywood satire than Entourage was going for. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So anyway, so it starts off with David Cross and Jay Mar being apparently their toy company has just been acquired by Globotech Industries. Yes,
and it's very funny because it's they work for Heartland Toy Company yes. being bought out by Globotech.
It just like the names themselves sound so like it's the Heartland.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you know, like Globotech immediately makes you want to do the voice that we've been doing. Right.
It's, yes. Exactly.
It sounds sinister.
Yeah. Yes, it's
like their CEO is basically played by Dennis Leary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Who's doing full on Dennis Leary. Like where he starts going, when he does show up, he reveals that, you know, he's fired everybody except for these two because he was really interested in the war, the commando elite that they had come up with. Mm-hmm. Which are these, like, you know, well, obviously like
first off, let's not forget, David Cross has his initial presentation, which is essentially think Avatar. Mm-hmm. He has basically like these not Avatar, you know, creatures, the Na'vi or whatever, but they're sort of like, I mean, really, they're sort of like from another planet, but very noble, savage coded type of thing.
Yes.
The called Gorgonites. The Gorgonites. And they're all sort of like monsters. Basically, they look like monsters, but they are. I found this to be an interesting, like, for what it's trying to do. The idea or the concept that maybe it's a little cliche, but it is fun to play with, right? The idea that the people who look the strangest or perhaps even the scariest are actually friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that once, Dennis Leary's character, the CEO, is just like thumbs down that shit.
David Cross, who's like, this is like his baby, his project, his whole thing is like, you know, we're not, they're gentle. They're not like, you know, so Dennis Leary doesn't see like where the play comes from. Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. And then, so Jay Mar being the more opportunistic of the two is able to just sort of scramble and like come up with like, basically it's G.I. Joe, but like just grotesques of G.I. Joe characters.
Yeah, exactly. Very, very like late 80s, like Schwarzenegger level.
Well, like super muscle-bound. Hyper muscular.
Yeah.
I, when I mentioned Avatar, this is not because I haven't thought about this. It's precisely because the lead character, Chip Hazard, Major Chip Hazard. Voiced by Tommy Lee Jones. But he absolutely looks like the guy from Avatar, the commander.
Played by Stephen Lang.
Mm-hmm. Exactly like that same sort of like very square jaw, square head, including mm-hmm. that just lovely flat top. and just hyper masculine, you know, just, mm-hmm. and he's got a knife because of course he's got to have a knife. He's got to have his commando knife. I do love that. As one of the, what was it? Because he has like a little presentation where the Chip Hazard punches his way out of his box.
Yeah,
he punches out of his fist, you know, just obliterates the plastic, and he pulls himself out, and the CEO's like, "Can he do that for real?" He's like, "No, we don't." He's like, "Well, never mind then." You know, like, maybe we should do so. Like, essentially, they come away with this idea that this is a great idea, but it needs something. The toys that play with you, or what was it? Everything else is just a toy.
Exactly. Which is such a good tagline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's where, like, it takes like a good 20 minutes to get that sort of set up, right?
It does, yeah. I think it's necessary, though, because it kind of starts off the whole, like, idea of, you know, war being entirely, you know, marketed to kids mm-hmm. via toys.
Yes, yes. No, I'm just sort of... Sort of amazed because it feels so, it's not that it's slow, but it feels very sort of different than what you'd get now, right? Where you need to have like something almost have to start it in media res, and then they would like backfill it later on with some sort of stupid flashback or, you know, mm-hmm. like whenever David Cross's or Jay Marr's characters show up in town later on, that's when they would give the info dump about like how this all started.
Right.
So this is where like basically we cut to, you know, small town USA, wherever.
Well, don't forget, however, now being, members of the Globotech family, Jay Moore has to find computer chips.
You're right.
For the Commando Elite.
Yeah, I jumped over that, and he manages to find, what is it like? Like he's just like doing some. It's like a stupid intranet search engine, and he's just like looking for cheap but very state of the art chips.
Yes.
That he could plug into his little toys.
Yeah, and he gets chips from the Globotech's like. Basically their military contractor side.
Look, I'm sorry, Chris. Look, I as I understand it, that's not a bad thing. That is the division of Raytheon that just concentrates on microwaves and little microchips. They don't really build the missiles. They just build the chips that go into the missiles. Very different.
Oh, okay, that's right. Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, like he orders.
They do
like
lots of good stuff, like sponsoring science fiction conventions. Ooh, and things like
that. Did they do that? I don't remember what happened.
Oh, I don't know. I'm just
you might have heard a vicious rumor out there, Chris. That never happened. But anyway, I also love now that I was like looking at this. So we get to small town USA. I don't remember what the name of the town is, but it's we get like the main character who's Alan Abernathy.
Mm-hmm.
And we quickly find out that like he has to sort of like man the store for his dad, who is Kevin Dunn. I always love watching like seeing Kevin Dunn in these older movies.
Yes, he's fantastic. I can't help but see him as his character from Veep now too.
Oh, from Veep.
Where he's like this like super like basically like misanthropic dude from Veep.
That's right. Isn't he one of the, that's right. He was like one of the strategy guys, right?
Yep. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he's just hating every moment of his life.
but yeah, so essentially, you know, push comes to shove. Basically, we get Dick Miller, Dick Miller cameo, because he's the guy who delivers the stuff to the store, and Alan sees like the Globotech Commando Elite boxes in there, and he's like, "Hey, maybe you could drop those off here, and we'll sell them."
Yeah. So Kevin Dunn has been running this kind of like small town mom and pop toy store. And his rule is no war toys, and his dad's going to be away for some sort of like convention, something for during the weekend. So Dick Miller shows up with these like brand new Commando Elite toys, and Alan, our main character here, decides he wants to make some money for the shop over the weekend and kind of prove to his dad that he can like run it and that he can be trusted and that he can like that his dad's ways might not always be the best. So he convinces Dick Miller to you know, kind of like lend him some of these toys.
He's like, hey, you know, he actually does like the thing where he's like, what's the how many times has something fallen off your truck?
Yeah, just, exactly.
Essentially like almost gives him like the wink, eh?
Yeah. Well, and I like Dick Miller's response was, hey, I don't like how you're saying that. He's like, it's too loud.
Yeah. But no, like he manages to convince him to leave him there, and like essentially, we're jumping over the fact that Kirsten Dunst is in this too.
Yes, yes.
As sort of like the somewhat romantic interest for Alan.
Mm-hmm. A couple years after Jumanji.
Yes, exactly. And so she shows up just to sort of show that she's around, but she's you know, still going out with this guy Brad, you know.
Yes.
So one of the things that struck me about this is that I feel like a lesser director would have made this completely about like nerds versus jocks or, you know, that type of thing. And and this is slightly more nuanced because it comes across like, sure, Alan and his dad they're not like they seem to be doing okay, but they're not like wealthy or anything.
Right.
And I mean, I would say that he's a small business owner in the US, so that's pretty good. He lives next to a maniac, played by none other than Phil Hartman, because
the king, Phil Hartman. I mean, apparently this was his last film before he died.
Oh no, man. I mean, he's just so good at playing like this type of, just super high strung kind of guy.
Yeah. But who's also very just like kind of unctuous, like real, like, you know, he knows exactly how to talk to everybody just yes. to get his way. Like, because we first meet him because he's installing a giant TV satellite, and the guy's saying, well, there's a tree in the way. He's like, well, not a problem. So he starts, and then he wants to like, you know, talk to the guy to take it down. But then like, he just starts doing it on his own.
it turns out that it's like, his neighbor's tree, which is, you know, Kevin Dunn's, the Abernathy's tree. Yeah. He's like yelling at him from the back porches. Hey, you can't cut that down. That's my tree. but I did find like he's just like a breath of fresh air in this movie.
Oh,
because
yeah.
It's funny that he's sort of in this, but is not like it's. I say it's funny because it feels so. Not save the cat to have a character who isn't immediately important to the plot. He's just sort of there.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And because he's kind of like, you know, he's Kirsten Dunst's dad. And he's just like, he's there to kind of be a foil to like Kevin Dunn and you know, kind of just, yeah, like you're right. Like he's just kind of like, everybody's got a dad, you know, and like they, that's just how, you know, the annoying dad across the way is going to be
right. Well, I mean, and the thing here is that I think in a lesser movie, because his sort of like his defining trait, is that he's like a complete technophile, right? He loves the high tech stuff. He like I love the scene where they have like the wide one of those early widescreen TVs that had like the wooden cabinet and shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Which, and he like sets it up, and I think this is a couple scenes ahead, but like he's like, oh, they're all like amazed at the picture, and it just shows you how far like tech has gone. I've never thought those like giant projection TVs looked good at all. but like it just looks so washed out, and
I mean, it was good enough for what it was, right?
Yeah.
Like I'll tell you that when my dad got one of those, I went out and immediately like rented out like Jurassic Park, and I forget what else. There was another movie that I was just like, yeah, finally a big we have a TV big enough to watch this and feel sort of like impressive, you know. But anyway, yeah, it doesn't compare to now, right? But hey, you know, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the funny thing is that what I was getting at is that his defining trait is that he's a complete technophile. And I feel like if this were to be like remade today, he'd be the guy that would figure out a way to undo like the, like use some tech to, you know, fight back or something, you know, he'd become important in that way. Right. And he's just sort of like a bit of a nuisance.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, so he's positioned as this foil to the Abernathys, who are kind of like, not like exactly like crunchy hippies or anything like that, but they're like a little bit more old fashioned because, you know, he doesn't want any war toys in his store. And you can kind of see there's a lot of like wooden type of old timey toys in his store.
It's the type of store where you'd find like lots of Melissa and Doug puzzles or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Yes, yes. And then like, you know, and then in contrast, here's Phil Hartman, who's all about like everything tech and, you know, up to date and, you know, yeah, exactly. So it's there's an interesting tension there between mm-hmm. those two.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't feel like it's super ham-handed. You said, the Abernathys are presented sort of like as like they the way they come across is, you know, that they're good, very good L.L. Bean wearing folks who might have had some hippie tendencies in the past, but not today. You know, it's the 80s. It's the 90s after all. But anyway, I do love that immediately upon the toys being like I believe Alan takes out like the head Gorgonite, which is Archer, voiced by Frank Langella. Like the
Frank Langella, yeah.
The cast on this is wild.
Yeah, Dante did some really weird, some interesting stuff with the voice cast of the toys. So the Gorgonites are Frank Langella as the lead guy. And then the three rest guys from Spinal Tap.
Yes, Spinal Tap.
And then the guy who did Winnie the Pooh's voice is one of the other guys.
Well, and then everyone except Tommy Lee Jones in the Commando Elites.
And Bruce Dern.
And Bruce Dern, but that's a special thing, was from the Dirty Dozen.
Yes, exactly.
And,
yep.
And Bruce Dern was brought in basically because, what was the name of the guy? One of them died before, you know, like production started rolling.
Well, he's been in a couple Dante films before too, like The Burbs. Yep.
Where he plays a bit of a hippie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I do love that immediately the toys just start like fucking up the place.
Yes, they go nuts.
I do want to repeat this. The Commando Elites, they look terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I said grotesques, like they all look like they're Joker-fied versions of like G.I. Joe characters, like G.I. Joe and Sergeant, Sergeant Rock or whatever the comic book, that type of thing. And it's just like, why would anyone want to play with these guys?
Well, yeah. And they're all grimacing and they have giant, like, you know, giant
lantern jaws or like huge. And then all of them are like super hyper muscular. Like you said, there's whatever his name, Bazooka, he looks
Brick
even
Bazooka,
Brick Bazooka,
Butch Meat Hook, Kip Killian, Nick Nitro, Link Static.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, like what? but yeah, like I love that the toys just tear up the place, and poor Alan has to sort of like close the store to sort of like pick things up, and Kirsten Dunst like helps him out, but then he forgets, or he puts Archer in his backpack. I forget if Archer like
He kind of like secrets himself in there.
I thought so. Yeah, I think he hides in there.
And there's also, so that it also comes out while they're kind of like cleaning up the place, is that, well, first of all, like Kirsten Dunst is like, you know, she's not your typical girl, because she doesn't like the, you know, something that everybody else likes, and she doesn't like that. But then also it comes out that Alan is not your typical, you know, like protagonist in these kind of movies either, because he's been expelled from two schools for unexplained reasons. Like, and so he's like, he's kind of like living down, and that's why they're relatively new in town, I believe. And, so he's like, you know, he's trying to run past that. And that's why his dad doesn't particularly, trust him, because of this kind of history.
Right. Well, it does feel, and correct me if I'm wrong, or if it's mentioned sort of overtly, but it does feel like he's sort of sent to mind the store, one as a trust exercise, but also as a way to sort of like keep him pinned down, basically.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, like he's trying to do okay. Like one of the things we forgot to mention is that he has to sort of like close the store briefly because his dad's forgotten his airplane ticket that he's going to go to a convention to. Mm-hmm. And so he bikes all the way home and manages to get him his airplane ticket before he gets into the car and finds out in the airport. So when it becomes clear that the store has been trashed, his dad gets a little mad at him because of, you know, like, you know, he thought that he was past all that, you know?
Right.
And of course, you know, nobody's going to believe him that it's the toys come alive.
Right.
But they do.
They do. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And like, it's funny because the Gorgonites, they're like, you know, they're alive as well, but they're kind of just like, they're just kind of just general. They don't really have much of a mission other than to find their home. Like that's their thing. But the commando elite right out of the box are like, we are killing the Gorgonites. Like the Gorgonites their whole mission now has been rejiggered to be nothing but like victims of the commando elite.
Well, I mean, I think that that's sort of an interesting thing to poke at, right? Because honestly, the fact that the commando elites, because they have such a simple mission, right? They're just fight the Gorgonites. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's crazy too, because it's, you know, they're posed, the Gorgonites are posed as like, you know, almost like an indigenous kind of like foreign population.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
Like, here's the American commando elite coming in to like wipe them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, so that's where I think like a lot of the biting, there is some biting, you know, anti-military, anti-war type stuff in this, because it's not just like the consumerism stuff, but it's also that, you know, America's like, you know, imperialist, you know, machine and things like that.
Well, I mean, and I think that there's something circling back to what I'd mentioned earlier, right? There is a bit of a. It may sound cliche now, but I still think that there is something to be said about presenting in a kids movie to kids that like, look, you know, those toys that you think look really cool. Well, what if those were the bad guys and the ones that look ugly to you are actually the good guys?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, no, exactly. Yeah.
And it gets kids thinking about that, you know, it's like, because that's, you know, it's that, the Garfield meme, right?
Yes.
Propaganda. Who is that for?
Well, yeah. And it's making, it's deliberately positioning as heroes, as the true heroes, you know, the pacifists. Now the movie kind of like throws that away a little bit at the end, but we can get to that. But, so it kind of like doesn't necessarily live up to that, but at least for the majority of it, you know, we're rooting for, you know, this group of, you know, people who just, who don't want to fight. Their skill is hiding. Like that's the one thing, like they're really good at hiding. So they're always like, you know, they have to be found, you know, and stuff like that. And I think it's there's kind of like that tension that of between like, you know, of like anti-war stuff. Even, you know, take for example the previous episode you guys did on toys, like the movie Toys with Robin Williams, where that's also the tension between, you know, typical or a classic example, classic idea of children's playthings versus the more modern like war stuff being shoved down everyone's throat.
Right. I do ultimately think that that something like Toys is sort of whimsy kind of also ends up, I mean, the whimsy and also the very muddled politics tend to defang the critique, but there is a critique there, you know, and I think that there is value to that.
Absolutely.
The same thing here. And I would probably argue, unless I'm misremembering, that we can get to it, but I would argue that at a certain point, just following your quote programming of hiding is essentially a strategy for you to lose. When essentially your enemy is there to kill you.
Right. Yeah.
So I would argue that there is, I think that that's something valuable as well, right? It's this idea. Granted, there's another problem with that, but we can get to it, right? Which is that, that ultimately Archer is not really the person who liberates the Gorgonites.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
But you know, that's another story. Now I would argue that it might be a little too much of a nuanced thing for like basically a kid's movie for 98, you know?
Right.
But if a future film developer is out there listening right now, there is a gap that you, that this is that gap that we're mentioning to you. So keep that in mind. Anyway, I forget because it takes a long time for the Commando elites to really get cooking. Well,
so after the storage is destroyed, Alan kind of leaves a voicemail on the Globotech's message, and that gets back to David Cross and Jay Moore that you know, he's complaining about the toys coming alive and that they're crazy. And they're investigating, and that's when Jay Moore reveals to David Cross that he got the chips from the, you know, the military side, and they go talk to the always lovely to see him, Robert Picardo, the doctor himself, and you know, he's like, "What did you do that for?" Like, and then he explains and gives us the idea that the only way to really defeat them is an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse. It's very funny because they're always like, "Well, all we need is a nuke."
yes, exactly. I mean, but that is, you know, as we've seen in many a movie that has some sort of a nuke. An EMP is that's what nukes do, right? When they enter the atmosphere.
Absolutely, yeah.
Actually, I guess when they explode in the atmosphere, they send out an EMP. But anyway, in any case, I do love that they feel, in this weird madcap sort of twist, they both head to the town, I guess, to get in front of the situation, because they're the only two people there, right? Essentially.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. So they eventually follow the commando elite follows Alan home, where they find Archer and they kind of like interrogate him. But then Alan saves, but then this is, it's funny because, so they're like torturing him over the garbage disposal.
That's right.
And so, and this is where it kind of like, I think kind of takes it up a notch where, one of the commando elite actually like cuts Alan's hand with like I forget what it was, but it's like some sort of cutting tool. And so it's like, I think it's interesting that like, I don't think every movie would have the protagonist actually be hurt by like, and draw blood, like visible blood from the toy. I think, you know, I think that's what kind of sets this a little bit apart from a lot of these kinds of movies where there's like actual physical violence being done by these toys.
Yeah. Well, I think to your point, in another movie, they would have probably like stuck him with like a pin or something, and it would have like hurt him, and you would have seen him like react, but there would be no blood, because like actually, you know, like penetrating the skin is like, you know, that's a violation, right? It's you are breaking the skin. So I do think that that's an interesting point. That's a good one. I think that, because then it also sets up like, it ratchets up the tension and sets up like this idea that Alan could be in danger from the toys.
Exactly right. Like, this isn't like, you know, a cut and dry thing where like they are a legit threat, and they're not like, you know, it's not like a goofy, much like the Gremlins were, you know? And I think, you know, this, it's a lot of this comes back to Dante, you know, willing to put this like level of chaos into these kind of like what are ostensibly like kids movies.
Well, and also let's not forget, this is made in 98, right?
Right.
And once, I believe once Alan does that, and anyone who tries to get in their way, in the way of the commando elite's mission of basically killing the Gorgonites, they immediately, they have a very binary view of the world, right?
Yes.
It's like, if they're essentially, you know, this is 3 years before, you know, if they're not with us, they're against us, right?
Yeah, exactly. That is something I wanted to talk about a little bit. Maybe we'll do it a little bit later or do it now, but the difference that this movie would look like, how different this movie would look like in a post 9/11 world, where I think a lot of their, you know, having the Dirty Dozen do the voices, and like, there's a lot of kind of like World War II kind of like symbolism. In fact, one of the best gags is after Phil Hartman gets his TV up and running, he puts on some sort of war movie, and him and his wife are sitting there watching, and she's not really paying attention, and he's like, I think World War II is my favorite war. And then he like munches on a potato chip, which is, I think it's a pretty like, it's a really funny line, and Phil Hartman like, you know, delivers it perfectly. But it's also, I think, kind of like sets, it's a perfect encapsulation of America's view on war, you know, as almost like a spectator sport. And the fact that, you know, we do have a favorite war, like World War II is clearly our favorite war because we won it. Like, you know,
we swooped in at the last minute and we won. But also I do think that, for all intents and purposes, it is the war that, for what it's worth, is probably the one that has the least moral issues, you know, at least the ground war. We're not going to get into, you know, the Japanese front or the Pacific front.
Right.
But yeah, like this idea that was the correct war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly right. But I think in a post 9/11 world, they, you know, instead of like the green camo, it'd probably be more like the desert camo, you know,
digitized weird.
Yeah,
that they have now.
Exactly.
Also, let's not forget that, for me at least, the funny thing about the World War II being his favorite war line, and the commando elites in sort of like, they're sort of in dissonance with each other, because the commando elites read very Vietnam.
Yes, that is true. That is true.
They have like built in, they have like an aggrievedness about losing a war almost. Not that they talk about it, they just act like that.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no, and I think, yeah, exactly. And they, well, and that matches with them, like, you know, going after this, like, you know, technologically inferior indigenous peoples in the form of the Gorgonites, you know, which is like, I think that's exactly right. That it's definitely Vietnam coded. And I mean, that would make sense for somebody of Joe Dante's, like, you know, his generation. That would be the most forefront on their mind.
I mean, I am positive that, you know, Joe, you know, was in some one or more marches, you know, against the Vietnam War.
Oh, I'm positive. Yeah, exactly. Right. My question too is, would he have been able to make a movie with the same kind of message in a post 9/11 world?
No.
Or
he would have made a brave effort, only to be booted halfway through and it be reshot or rewritten or both, right. You know, well, right. Both of them are almost the same thing. But this time with much more Pentagon upstream Pentagon script approval.
Exactly right. Yeah.
And they would find a way to really complicate the Gorgonites so that they, yeah, sure, they look and act peaceful. Mm-hmm. But you know, like, I don't know, they'd have some sort of shitty, horrible, like, maybe they give the kids cancer or something. I don't know.
Or there's like one Gorgonite who's actually like a rabid fanatic and, you know, like that kind of thing, like where it's exactly.
They would have, all the other Gorgonites have to disavow that one.
Exactly. Yeah.
They say anything. Yep. Anyway, yeah, it would definitely be like the usual thing that we've seen since, right? Which is, mm-hmm. like, sure, yeah. those guys are bad, but yeah, you know, sure, we're bad, but those guys, ugh, they're worse.
Yeah. Look what they made us do, how we're so sad about it.
Yes. But yeah, like I really did also enjoy when they do manage to do, well, I'm sorry, this is, the EMP is like their, it is in fact their nuclear option, because
right.
they managed to essentially like kill all of the commando elites and leave Chip Hazard sort of like, mm-hmm. moribund and floating away in some offflow creek, right. or something.
Before they do that, though, it's interesting that they actually take Kirsten Dunst hostage, right? Mm. And, like, you know, threaten her, and then they convert her, quote, all her
like Barbie Gwendy dolls or whatever.
Yeah, but all I guess Wendy, they didn't get the Barbie dolls license, so they're Gwendy dolls. Into like Frankenstein's monsters of like, and it's funny
and they're all like hypersexual too. They're like,
yes.
Oh, hey, big boy, what are you doing? Yeah. What are you doing tonight?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and they're all, yeah, but they're all like, yeah, they're all very girly, like tip, you know, the stereotypical of that ilk of like, kind of like bubbly, like, yeah, it's
well, and they got Sarah Michelle Gellar and Christina Ricci to voice the Gwendy dolls.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah, it's so good.
It works. That's perfect. It's ideal. Yeah. But then they show up. It's like nobody's really believing Alan and Christy, who is Kirsten Dunst's character, until the two toy guys like Rent just show up at their house and are like, sorry about that. And then it was interesting where I like the line where Alan's like, your toys are screwing up or something like that. And Jay's like, tell me more about, Jay Moore is like, tell me more about that. Now, keep in mind, I may call you into a court of law to, you know, back up your back up your claims.
but yeah, like I really, yeah, it is very I'd forgotten that. Yeah, like that would probably also give it another ding for towards the PG-13. Keeping someone hostage, a young girl hostage, and also like threatening her life.
Oh yeah, they were like ready to kill her.
Yeah, that would probably do it. They also, let's not forget, this was the one that apparently Burger King ran like some Happy Meal or whatever their thing is, their Happy Meal toys. But they had to put a disclaimer about the toys not being, essentially the toys did not nice things, so be careful, or you could ask for different toys, because they had catapulted, remember, they catapulted two sleeping pills into the drink.
Oh, Yes. Yeah. So yeah, they drug to, in order to like capture Kirsten Dunst. They drug Phil Hartman.
Her mom and dad. Yeah.
Yeah. And they catapult two sleeping pills into each drink. And it is funny. And I also think it's like kind of funny to see. I can't think of another movie that just like shows like two adults casually having a drink like that, like on like what is seems like a weekday, it's crazy that it's. I mean, everybody does it. Like it's like, you know, it's a normal thing, but like I just feel like that's kind of like a thing that gets easily sanitized away.
Yeah, it feels like it's gone the way of like smoking.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I mean, I don't care either way, but I can understand why, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
But yeah, like I do agree that it is sort of I guess it's that that pinch of broad appeal, right? You need to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, and you know, like. And so people don't like to drink. Well, let's get the focus group said that they don't like people drinking in movies. So we got to get rid of that.
Right. Exactly.
But anyway, I did that's one of the things here, right? Where the adults also engage in like little tiny adult other behaviors, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Just not be responsible. You know, they're not just the people in charge or whatever. They also mm-hmm. have like other lives that are hinted at here.
Yes, exactly right. But so like as you said, they destroy all the commando elite except for Chip Hazard, who
like, drifts down the river like Apocalypse Now style.
Yes, exactly.
And then when he manages to climb out of the bank. And this is all because they were merciful and let him live. They left him for dead, right? They didn't right. chop him up into pieces after the fact. They just sort of like, oh, he looks dead. Okay, bye. See ya. And he climbs out and he's basically on the embankment across like a giant parking lot of, I mean, it's not a Toys R Us, but it should be. It's like a toy castle or whatever the fuck the brand name is. And you're like, and just in case you didn't figure it out, there's a big Globotech truck just sitting there on the loading bay. And you're like,
exactly right.
Well, I guess reinforcements. Well,
isn't there a giant inflatable Chip Hazard too? Right?
Oh, like, you're right. That's the first thing he looks up and he sees like a giant inflatable Chip Hazard. But yeah, like that's where I was like, oh shit, reinforcements.
Yep. And so then they kind of like siege the house and are like, and they show up with like improvised
vehicles and weaponized vehicles.
Yeah, like a nail gun that shoots like nails, like, and like nails. A flamethrower.
Yeah, like a little mini flamethrower, or the one that would launch like tennis balls on fire.
Mm-hmm. Well, and keeping in you know, up with the, you know, they're actually injuring people. At one point, they stab Alan with like a bunch of like corn cob holders in his leg.
Yeah, in his leg.
Yeah.
I winced when I saw this. I was like, shit, dude. That's that would smart. Yeah, like these
people are actually like legit getting hurt from these toys.
Well, no, and that's the other thing, right? I think that this entire sort of like the battle sequence, it does give you like there's like it doesn't feel like they might be able to get out of this, you know?
It
feels like they're gonna burn down the house around them, you know? That's
right.
So it does have like that sense of danger to it, mm-hmm. which is rather convincing.
Yes, exactly. And that's when David Cross's character, like, you know, mentions the EMP, but they need a nuclear bomb and nobody has one, of course. So they kind of come up with this, like, and this kind of like bugged me, but not like in a CinemaSins kind of way, but like the idea being that if they blow up the electrical transformers on the nearby electrical poles, it will also generate an EMP, which is like, I've been near those kind of transformers when they blew, which they're cool because it goes off this like blue like flame type of thing, but like they don't give off an EMP as far as I remember.
Chris, shh, quiet, Chris.
Yes. Yes. Now, like I said, I am not doing CinemaSins nonsense.
But. Can't you hear that? That's the hand waving, Chris. Come on. I mean, I was pretty sure it was not, but also like, it seems rather like the minute they're like, yeah, but you need to nuke, and you're like, that doesn't seem like a good solution. I don't know.
Yeah. But yeah, exactly. So, I mean, like, it's ultimately it's fine because it gives them a thing they need to do. It's across the street and they're being bombarded. And
I mean, it maintains that street to street fighting type of feel, yep, that the movie's established by this point.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And there's a lot of good gags of where like other neighbors are kind of being awoken by this, but they kind of like don't really like look into it further. Like where it's limited to just these two households.
Yes. Alike in dignity.
Yes.
But yeah, so Alan is the one to go out and he's supposed to like basically bridge the two Transformers. I am not a smart person. I don't know about Transformers or electricity, but he's supposed to touch them together so that the current goes from one to the other, and that's what causes the explosion, yada yada yada,
right? But he originally has a monkey wrench, mm-hmm, you know, and that's what he uses, but then he drops it and then Chip Hazard shows up and he eventually grabs Chip Hazard and uses him to bridge the two Transformers.
Yeah, not before Chip Hazard tries to basically stabs his finger again, tries to have him fall. Well, he does fall off the electrical pole, like a mm-hmm good 20 feet, like onto his back. Yep. Good thing he's like 13, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Only exactly. Yeah. Like somebody that young would be able to like withstand that.
Sort of like bounce back from it, dust himself off, and
yeah,
maybe have some issues like when he's 45, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I do want to point out that that Archer, he does find Archer there. Archer does try to help, but is. Basically, you know, Chip Hazard fends him off. Mm-hmm. He falls, you know, he tosses him off the electrical pole. And it's down to him or Alan. And that's where Alan, like, just sort of like does a Hail Mary grab and just like jams Chip directly in between the two Transformers.
Right.
Which is satisfying. I feel like it's a cathartic moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But
he totally fries up. But, you know, getting to that point too, where like they, you know, as like the final stand type of thing, the Gorgonites decide that they need to actually fight back.
Yeah.
Whereas like before they've been, you know, all they've been doing is hiding and letting other people fight. And I think that kind of a little undermines the whole like positioning before where they were being like, you know, it was, you know, valorizing kind of like the pacifists and but the ultimate idea being, oh well, but sometimes you have to fight back.
Well, I mean not to belabor it, but I do think that they do have that scene where Archer comes to the realization and sort of convinces the other Gorgonites that like hiding is a losing strategy when essentially Chip Hazard and the crew are just they're never going to stop.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you know, I mean, yeah, exactly.
So I do think that they try to explain in a non ham-handed way, you know, the reasoning behind it. So, you know, like, yeah, I would agree that like, I guess my issue isn't necessarily that it muddles up like the pacifism angle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that to a certain extent, it's taking the stance that you should avoid conflict. You shouldn't seek it out or make conflict. Right. You should try to just sort of connect with nature and, you know, and that type of thing. But if push comes to shove,
yeah,
you got to sort of defend yourself in some way.
Yep, that's true.
So I do think that that's I think it's a valuable way of thinking. I do also think that there, if this were other kids' media, it would be very much like Archer, like, you know, like at the moment that he's going to, like, I don't know, like, it's not something that happened in the movie, but like, imagine that, you know, Chip Hazard's the one that's dangling off the electrical pole and Archer's above him. He would, like, you know, oh, but I can't do that. That would make me as bad as he is. And, you know, he lifts him up and then hugs him and that's it, you know?
Yeah.
And that is, I'm sorry, that's complete bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an okay thing for, like, little kids.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like, when you're seeking out somebody, an entire people's extermination, it's only fair that they fight back.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. I think this is something very topical.
I wasn't going to mention it, but
yes,
you know, I could just leave it there. I think,
but I think everyone, if you know, you know, and how could you not?
Right. And then of course, like, Globotech arrives on the scene then at the end, Devin O'Sleary, and he's like thrilled with the how everything went.
This was actually the most speculative aspect of the entire thing for me, because as he's walking through, everyone that complains to Dennis Leary's character, he snaps his fingers and his assistant writes out a check.
And she had some like fancy like check writing machine too. Did you see that?
and he just sort of like, she knows exactly the number. But anyway, that was the most speculative aspect, because you know that nowadays that would just be, no, you get you get zero.
Yeah, you get nothing, and the government will protect them. So
yes, yeah. I mean that would be the part of the movie that in a remake would stay.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, and then, you know, he's like, oh, I have some customers in, what did he say, Latin America or something like that.
Yeah, sort of hinting at the more of the death squads in El Salvador and whatnot.
Right, exactly. And then there's also I'm sorry, I'm blanking on something. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I think we sort of got to the end of this. I think that this is still a rather solid movie, if not quite as biting as I would have liked it.
I just remembered what I did want to mention. So the Gorgonites, like, have this like they've essentially become like fully functional AI like robots, right? Like, and they're able to like regenerate themselves because they fix the one guy after he's like injured, and Alan like sends them off in the canoe off to find like homeland. So like there's just like these like artificially intelligent robots out there somewhere. Like, so there is like some, a real, like, you know, twist there at the end, not twist, but like a science fiction kind of decent idea there at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, it is sort of, I did find it funny that, the ship that they're on is a longboat. It's a long ship. You're like,
yeah,
are they going to go Viking now?
Yeah.
but yeah, like, honestly, I do wonder what this is what, like, 10 to like, I would say this is like what, a tween movie, right?
Yeah,
like 8, I would say 8 to 12 probably, right? I wonder what an 8 to 12-year-old nowadays would think of this.
Yeah, I honestly like, I think my wife would not want me to show this to my daughter, because she's 7, so she's like right on that cusp there. But I think my wife would think it'd be too violent.
I mean, it is violent.
Yeah.
But I would argue that much like Gremlins and Gremlins 2, it is very much a Looney Tunes style of violence.
Yes. Yes.
Outside of like the human characters, right? Because like,
right.
And even then, like, the human characters don't really get, you get like the little cut that Alan gets and threats of violence against the other, like Kirsten Dunst's character and whatnot. But like, there's not really a body count, even though like the commando elites are like, you know, very much like, well, if you're Gorgonite and Gorgonite allies are both on their hit list, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like I'm glad I saw this. This is the first time I saw it. So it's like,
interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I'm way beyond the target age for this, but I think it would, if I had seen it like when I was younger, I'm pretty sure I would have enjoyed it.
Yeah. I really liked this movie a lot when I was a kid. I hadn't seen it for a very long time. And then it recently came out on Blu-ray. So I picked it up and rewatched it. I thought it held up. It's, you know, it has some fun. It doesn't, there's some really good action. There's a little bit of some wonky CGI, but it's not egregious.
I was going to mention that just briefly, because when I was reading it, I noticed obviously there's some scenes where it's pretty obvious. Something about the flesh tones on the Commando Elites specifically. It's something about like that that pink flesh, doll flesh color that the mm-hmm. CGI of the time just made it slightly purplish.
Right.
And you can tell right away and you're like, okay, that's the CGI. But honestly, this film did a really good job. And I was sort of surprised at how much the Commando Elites are portrayed in CGI, which is like, I think, or not just the Commando Elites. I think the Gorgonites as well. In many instances, the other ones, the secondary ones that aren't Archer, but, it's amazing that 2/3 of the scenes that they're in are CGI and there's only 1/3 that's puppets. And for the most part, I sort of was bought in.
Yeah, exactly. It's not, like I said, not egregious. Like it wasn't like, oh my God, like it wasn't like,
I mean, yeah. I would also argue that that perhaps they leaned into like the grotesque character designs in part so that they would be easy to sort of CGI and look realistic, right? Mm-mm. Because they look totally like they look awful. they look horrible.
Yeah,
I mean, but it's on purpose. Don't get me wrong. Like the brick bazooka, Jesus Christ, looks like
these are like you know, like roided out, like you know, super soldier type dudes.
Yeah, they just look ugly.
Yes.
But yeah, and I think the character designs are very ugly on purpose. Like that was my read on it, is like make them as ugly and as cartoonishly ugly as possible so that the CGI looks realistic.
Yep.
I mean, it worked more or less.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, I think that is it for me. I don't have anything else other than like, this is pretty rad. I liked it.
Yeah.
Like,
yep. Joe Dante delivers.
I earlier said I would have liked it if I had seen it when I was younger, but honestly, that sounds like it. I didn't like it now, and I rather did. But anyway, Chris, did you have any other last thoughts or?
Everything else is just a toy.
There you go. All right. Well, and what would that mean for us, right? I mean, everything else is just a podcast? Wait.
Yeah.
What does that make us? Anyway. Thanks again, Chris, for recommending this one. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time here on Podside.